Radar Station, RT Radio 1.
Good afternoon. How you doing? Hope you are well. Hope you're safe. Hope you are warm and dry in the aftermath of Storm Ellen. And I know a lot of people still out of power and trying to get back on their feet again. So let me know how you're doing. Some of you were listening on battery operated radios, I heard this morning when Tubbs was on. So are you still in the battery, in the land of batteries? Are you back on 51551 or ray@rte.ie? And just caught the end of Liveline there with Katie. And again, like, it's a lot of back to schools. They're the conversations that have certainly escalated on my WhatsApp groups as well. And I'm, you know, even though Ellie isn't of school going age, I've all of my friends have kids who are. And there is a huge level of nerves and there is growing anxiety and uncertainty because it's tomorrow week. You know, it's just, that's how quickly it's coming. And I know some schools are opening on Thursday. So after 5 months, there just seems to be a lot of anxiety. And look, I think it's fair to say that teachers feel the same. Everyone's trying to do their best. And the government have put out the guidelines. Schools are trying to get messaging out there. But a friend of mine sent me a message last night to say that she had gotten an email from the primary school. And essentially it was saying, we're doing everything to ensure the safety of your children and that we're currently working on a back to school plan. And I just thought, wow, I mean, you'd kind of, that would be fine if it was 6 weeks that schools were opening, or you got the email 6 weeks ago, but this is all happening next week. So there's just a lot of, you know, I think worry. And I think because stuff is changing on a daily basis, on a weekly basis in terms of COVID, but just even stuff that was on the flying around the WhatsApp group this morning, like some of the moms were wondering, had the school informed of drop-off locations? Can childcare pickup services happen? Do uniforms need to be washed every day? Do parents have a say in the pods that the children are put in? So I think it's just, there's nobody really has an idea of what next week is going to look like. And then another friend of mine was telling me that her child, who is going into junior infants, they won't be allowed to hold hands. That nearly broke my heart. And it's, again, it's a reminder that they are going into a very different world too. And I suppose as much as we can as parents, we try and kind of shield them from our anxiety and our worries to try and make the transition back after 5 months as seamless as possible. But I mean, they're so astute as well. And so I'd just love to know how you're doing today, how you're feeling about the back to school. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. How are the kids feeling about going back as well? Now, what else? Yes, I read today that apparently we make up to 35,000 decisions a day. Now, that is a lot of thinking, and I personally can't vouch for myself with those numbers. But apparently, when you think about it, it's 773,000 decisions throughout our life, and 143,000 of them we come to regret. So it was this study on a financial website that I was reading. But then you know, you wake up some mornings and you're very alert, and the decisions come easy, they come quick. You know what's going on. You've crossed everything off your to-do list by 11 a.m. They're the rarities those days. Mostly it's sitting on the end of the bed for 10 minutes after your shower wondering who you are, or are they your feet, or standing looking in the wardrobe for 5 minutes wondering what in the hell you're going to put on you. But it just got me thinking about decisions and the amount of decisions that happen throughout the day and throughout our lives. And I want to then know, what is the best decision you have ever made? Not the ones that we come to regret, all 143,000 of them throughout our lives. Let's leave those ones out. Let's concentrate on the best decisions that you've made in your life. Let me know, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Reeling in the Years was in the Indo today. And of course, we were talking about earlier in the week about our favourite moments. And it's such a great show. And Gabia Gadavecsia in the Indo today, she was writing about how brilliant it is in terms of educating ourselves on modern Irish history. So, you know, we all learn in school about the Easter Rising and Cromwell and Pádraig Pearse and all that. But actually, what she's saying, it's a really good educational platform for modern Irish history, and something that we could sit the kids kids in front of 6:30 and learn from it. So again, just another thumbs up for reeling in the years there. And there was another headline that caught my eye in the Daily Mail. ABBA's classic Dancing Queen is voted Britain's biggest floor filler. So Dancing Queen, it came ahead of Come On Eileen and It's Raining Men. So the songs that get you up to have a boogie. And of course, we were doing Guess the Song yesterday and it got me thinking, what is our favourite? If we were to do an Irish compilation, like say the top five songs that get you up no matter what you're, because we've all missed those days. We've missed whether it's dancing in a nightclub or kicking off the heels at a wedding and racing out to have a boogie in the middle of the dance floor. When can we do that again? When can we dance with abandon? And so why don't we have a look and see if we can create Ireland's top five favourite floor fillers. Five favourite floor fillers. Easy for me to say. Need another coffee for that. So we did a little bit of team research and this was producer Neve's favourite tune to go for a boogie. Every single person in the house tonight, the day you sing it, she's a maniac. She's a maniac. Those that brings back so many memories. Then we had Niels, and Niels was Rock the Boat. So I'd like to know where you got the notion. Said I'd like to know where you got the notion. Rock the boat. Don't rock the boat, baby. Rock the boat. Yes, it's the El Classic. Always a good one at a wedding as well. And then this was my one. I love a bit of Beyonce on a night out. Okay, so get me your favourite floor fillers, 51551 or ray@rte.ie, and we'll do Ireland's top five classic boogie tracks. Lots of texts coming in here. Apart from the 1 hour COVID training, my niece who's returning to sixth year will not be back to school until the 8th of September. Some schools are delaying way too long. That comes in from a Wexford listener. Catherine, here's a laugh for you. We've gotten no roadmap for reopening from school, but just a text for €90 from each school to book rental. It's doable to ask for money, but no plan. That comes in from Anna. We got our detailed school plan last week for the reopening of our school on Tuesday, the 1st of September. A lot of work has gone into the plan. I'm nervous for the kids going back. I think children need it. My three girls are very excited to return. And I think kids are so resilient. They will adapt very well. And they are better than some adults at the whole hygiene situation. Best decision. Oh, yeah, we were talking about your best decisions ever. Best decision ever was to adopt my dogs. True love. Nothing like doggy love. Okay, here come your favourite tracks. In the Mood for Dancing by the Nolan Sisters. Oh, that's a good one. I think that'll be a popular one. Celebrate by An Emotional Fish. Can't Beat It, says Aaron in Galway. All right, keep them coming in. Galway Girl, they're coming in thick and fast. But you know what? I'm going to indulge me. Let's have a little bit of Beyonce to get us in the mood. That is the incredible Beyonce and my number one floor filler. And I have to say, since March, I've probably danced around the kitchen to that no less than 50 times. Jer in Bray's floor filling track is The Huckle Book. Somebody else says, Tiffany, I Think We're Alone Now. Oh, yes, that was a classic. I think we might have to dig that one out for sure. YMCA says Paul. Karen, couldn't agree with you more. Thunderstruck, AC/DC. You don't have to be a good dancer. You just jump around enjoying it. That's always a great one at a wedding, isn't it? Don't Stop Believing. Yes, by Journey. Dancing Queen, Teenage Kicks. The Love Shack by the B-52s. That's another great one. Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. Sweet Caroline, Build Me Up Buttercup, another great track. Okay, keep them coming in and we will make a compilation of Ireland's top, let's go top five, I think that's what I said, let's go top five dancing, the songs that make us get up and dance and feel great and encourage everybody to have a good time. Then we were talking about decisions. My best decision was going back to education 45 years after leaving school, 14 to go to work. At 14 to go to work, I learned so much driving and swimming beforehand from Esther in Blarney. My absolute best decision was adopting our wonderful son in Russia on the 24th of August 1999. Love the show. That's from Molly. Thanks, Molly. Brian says, my best decision was quitting drinking a year ago. I've never felt better. Honestly, I think if more people got away from it for a while and see how much better they feel, a lot of people would just be a a lot happier, I think. Fair play to you, Brian. Thanks for texting that in. Best decision was to have the opportunity to join Tralee Golf Club 3 years ago. It's paradise, says Eleanor. Noreen says the best decision I ever made in my life was spending the New Year 2000 with my dad in hospital, passing up on all the New Year millennium parties. He died the 6th of February 2000, no regrets. What a wonderful memory to have. And for that to be the best decision of your life, wow, that's pretty powerful. And fair play, Noreen. And then back to school. Oh my God, I got a text last night to say after school can't take our three kids after being promised a place last June. Wow, oh my gosh, how do you even begin to start to manage that and organise your week and your days? Wow, that's pretty, and I'm sure there's a lot of people still going through all of those issues. That is, I haven't heard that one though. I mean, promised a place last June. That's tough. All right, keep them coming in. 51551 or ray@rte.ie.
Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Keep your texts coming into 51551 and your emails to ray@rte.ie. Now, today is a big day for one man, and the well wishes have been flooding in all day because legendary commentator Micheál An Mhuire Shuartaigh is 90 today, and he is on the line for a quick hello. Cohorticus Micheál and Lá Breatha Honadich.
Good me le mahal go to go sis la u to go con brella marshin the vehicle. I'm in some dying and a punta kiri. Tan log a heaving, be an ehe godona, a tan spare a gusanari, a guscacla, the fecund gohunt of my nino.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. And I'm glad I understood most of that. I'm trying to practice my cupola focal Oscoelga Micheál.
They're coming.
So you're in Dingle having a lovely time with family. How are you feeling today? Can I ask you actually, first of all, what age do you feel today?
Well, I never felt age. I never worried about age. I always looked forward. Positive outlook on life and so on. And I think I mentioned it in several programs over the years. A little prayer I had from my grandmother when I was very, very young, because she died before I was 5 years of age. And it's a little bit of Irish. Urni amuinuk imlanavgum fein, dushuk le duruk le braca on lay. And translated, that means a little prayer taught to me in my youth, to wake up every morning full of enthusiasm for the day ahead. And I think that's a great motto to have, to be looking at every day at the start of that day, saying to yourself, this is going to be a great day. Yeah. I'll enjoy this day. That's the outlook I had on life. And I never worried about age or anything like that. We have no power over it. The man above decides all that. So I decided, better leave everything to him.
Yeah. And you've been, that's your attitude. You always have a very positive attitude on life, and you've been a very solid spokesperson for older people over the years. And we know, like, look at COVID has been a tough time for so many people who've had to cocoon. Do you find over the last couple of months that it has been more difficult to stay positive? Like, how are you finding life at the moment?
Well, I live out in the country in County Meath. And once I heard, you know, the suggestions at the beginning for those that were over 70 years of age, and that was to stay within your own reach, your own area, as much as you can. I think they put 5 kilometres on at that time. It was a penance in a way, but I kept to it because the words were coming from experts. And I think it's better to take the advice of experts in situations like that. That's what I did. And it didn't worry me. The days and the weeks and the months have gone by, and I'm still looking forward to the next few weeks and so on. And I think it's working well, the system that they brought in about people over 70. I'd like to have more freedom. I know they changed it lately, that you could travel anywhere within Ireland. Now, that's what brought us to Dingle, because I was born in Dingle, returned there every year since I left it. I know a lot of people there and so on. So that's why we decided to take a spin down.
Good for you.
And be here for the draft day, play a few holes of golf and enjoy the scenery and everything about it.
And have you been out to play golf yet?
I have indeed now. We have played golf on 7 of the last days that we're here. And before nightfall tonight, we'll have another round played. Or the most of a round, anyway.
And you're just unreal. That's fabulous. Ahead. That's fabulous, Micheál. You played golf for the last 7 days.
7 out of the last 8 days. And we were going to play yesterday, but grandchildren, because they rang me. I didn't know. They were saying they were lonesome above in North County Dublin in Souris. And they were lonely there. But I didn't know that at the time they were on their way down to be with us for the birthday and so on.
Fabulous.
So they all surprised us by arriving here at the door sometime last night. And we had a great night for that, but it put off the golf for last night. We were ready to go out. The sky had cleared and everything. At 10:45 at night, there's a different climate here. We're the nearest parish to America. So we were ready to go out, but another cloudburst came, so we skipped it. But we'll be there this evening.
So how are you going to celebrate now today?
Well, we got up early and we went to the beach because I knew the grandchildren would go for the beach. My daughter, Aideen, she's the mother, and Sean, he comes from Monaghan. I knew they'd love to go to the beach because they love everything about Kerry. And each of them, you know, they think they were born here. They think that they'll be here all their life when they come for a holiday. They were down, so we went to the beach this morning. We were down there very early. It's a very fine day here. Fantastic waves coming in over the Shamrock Rock and making their way, helping the tide, fighting against the tide. We were there to see both aspects of tidal action so far today.
Fabulous, fabulous. And can I ask you, Micheál, have you missed the matches? Have you missed going to matches and the fact that everything has had to been put on hold across the board?
Well, but since January of this year, I had the diary of matches for the whole year. Mm. And every week that went by, I'd open a new page of weekend and I'd know this is where I should have been today if this virus hadn't decided to include Ireland with all the other places. So there's no way. We have to do the best. And the players and everything. I met a Kerry player on the beach as well, keeping fit, hoping that he'll be called again. I don't think he will because he's already won 5 All-Ireland medals, but he's as fit as he ever was. And he was out walking. And I know even though there's no training allowed, I would say that individually they're out running and walking and maybe taking an odd kick to themselves. But hopefully the matches will go on. I missed the matches in a big way. Not so much the matches, but meeting the type of people that I met over the last, I don't know how many years, 60-something years, and maybe over 70 now. I think I've seen 78 All-Ireland football finals.
Wow.
That includes replays. The same would be true of hurling. So if you put the two together, I have seen, would that be now, maybe it might be over 150 senior finals if you include the hurling and the football. And it's a great memory to have.
It certainly is.
And to meet people from different generations that I knew or that I had heard of before that. I always liked that.
And you've given us so many memories to cherish, the whole country, Micheál. And, you know, earlier I was talking about decisions and the best decisions that we've made in our lives. We make a lot of decisions through life. And on your 90th birthday today, would you be able to tell us what's been your best decision that you've made in your life?
I would say to give up smoking. Now, in my youth, smoking was supposed to be very good for your health.
Yeah.
It would give you extra strength. It was good for the mind. And I know it was an accident, but I had my first smoke with my brother Nash at the age of 2 or 2.5.
Wow.
Going into a wake and seeing that everybody going in took up a pipe from the window full of tobacco. They lit a match, they set fire to it, and they went in. We said, if they're doing it, we're expected to do it. So we had our first smoke there. But it was common now, even when I was in primary school, that a lot of boys would be smoking.
Yeah.
The same way in the second level. There was nothing bad about it. It was good for your health. But then the first time that I ever had something or read something that was condemning smoke, I said, that's the last for me. And I never held one even in my hand since then.
Well,
and that's a good way to go. I think that was a very good decision.
What age were you? What age were you when you gave up, Micheál?
When I gave up, I gave it up one time during the junior. It was the junior, the exam you did at the...
The junior cert.
Junior cert, I think that's what they called it.
Right.
I must have believed somewhere that there was harm in it.
Mm.
I decided myself that I would not smoke while the exam was on.
Isn't it just a different time? I mean, it's just, it's phenomenal.
Not then. And then once the exam was over, I started again when I went to college in Ballyvoorn, a college years ago, to be a teacher. We were all smoking there. We were allowed smoke. We had a shomra for it. Shomra na mrog. That's where you'd leave the boots.
Isn't that just...
That was the smoking room as well. And we all smoked and nobody worried about it. But then sometime later, when I read about... for the first time about the damage that smoking can do to you. I said to myself, that's enough for me, and I didn't hold a cigarette in my hand ever since.
And
I think that was a good decision.
And it stood to you at 90 years of age today on your birthday. You know, it has been...
One more decision I took now. I didn't take it, but I never had any desire to drink. I was often in pubs with friends, telling stories, listening to stories and so on. But I never thought that I'd like drink. I'd drink maybe lemonade or a drop of tea or a drop of coffee. And I spent many an hour with people discussing things in pubs in different parts of the world, really.
Yeah.
But it never attracted me to it.
Mm. It's stood to you. You've made many great decisions in your life, and obviously having a fantastic family and grandchildren all around you today who love you and will shower you with love. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you. As I said, you've given us so many memories ourselves, and I hope today you make lovely memories with your family. Happy birthday again, Micheál, and thanks for taking the call.
Yeah. Goramina Mahagot Catherine Nagus Gomeramid Bio Renam Sharish. That means may we all live to this day next year.
Goramahagot Micheál.
Barte.
Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
So much love coming in for Micheál and Muirhearthig, who I was chatting to before the break there on his 90th birthday. Stephen says, the saying of living legend is overused in my opinion, but when it comes to the legend that is Micheál, it could never be overused. Happy birthday and many happy returns. Helena says, Catherine, please wish Micheál a very happy birthday. We met him over 20 years ago in Ennis and again 10 years ago in Castlebar. He was a total gentleman, so down to earth. He even signed a card for my late dad, Paddy, who was a big fan. Sarah says, Catherine, fab listening to Micheál and happy birthday to him. Loved the piece about his kids and his grandkids. I'm from Kerry, living in Dublin, and my two boys think they are Kerrymen. They're 5 and 9. He's a legend. That comes in from Sarah. What a legend he is, and a big happy birthday to him again. Okay, my next guest is a woman who went out for a post-lockdown picnic with family and friends and ended up discovering a treasure trove of Stone Age artefacts. Marion Dowd is on the line from Sligo. How are you, Marion?
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Now, I should say, because you are actually an archaeologist, but this was an accidental find, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was out with my son, Fiacra. We were meeting friends of ours and we went for a walk. And then after the walk, we decided to go for a picnic. So Fiacra was scouting around the edge of Glencar Lake looking for the perfect picnic spot. And yeah, as we started getting into our picnic, I noticed an archaeological artefact on the ground, and that's where it all started.
So I would have been sitting there having a picnic and opening the tinfoil and the sandwiches and not noticed. But the fact that you just happened to be the right person in the right place at the right time meant that you found this treasure trove, and it was a big haul.
Yeah, well, it started off just noticing one piece, and then I started looking around and thought, oh, wow, there's quite a lot of artefacts in this area. They were
so can I stop you there? What was the piece that you found that you noticed first?
So it's what we call a convex scraper. So it's a little stone scraper, and the type of stone that they were using is chert. It's a black stone, kind of like flint, but not as good quality as flint. So this little scraper would have been used in prehistory for things like, you know, scraping animal hides, or if they were catching fish, maybe for gutting fish. So that was the first piece I noticed. And then as I started looking around, I saw a lot of what we call debitage. So this is the waste material. If you're making artifacts from stone, making stone tools, you get a lot of waste pieces of stone, and they have very distinctive features. Mm. So we could see then that they were actually sitting at that spot making these stone tools, including some of the scrapers, and also using those tools.
And so how old have they been estimated to be?
Well, we're still carrying out analysis on the material. So they're at least 4,000 years old, but they're possibly up to 7,000 years old. So I should just say that, you know, when we did discover them, we immediately notified the National Museum and the National Monument Service. And with them, with the museum and the National Monument Service, we worked out the best strategy for surveying and recovering them. So with funding and support of the National Monument Service, myself and my colleague James Bonsall carried out that work and retrieved the assemblage. So the next stage now is having those analysed in detail.
And is it unusual, Marion, that it would have been that big an inventory, if you like, where you don't have to go digging and excavating, that they all seem to be scattered around on the surface around you?
Yeah, I suppose what was key to this is that they were exposed during the very hot weather in June. So we had about 2 weeks of really hot weather there in June, and the levels of the lake dropped at that time. So this surface with all these chert tools became exposed. And normally that area would be completely submerged under the waters of the lake.
Okay.
It was just the chance that we happened to go there at that particular time. So, I mean, since then, it's pretty much been completely covered over by water again. And it could be another 12 months before that part is exposed if we get any more sunshine.
OK. And so this was beside Glencar Lake. So that's up the sort of Sligo-Leitrim border, is it?
So Glencar Lake, part of it is in County Sligo, and part of it is in County Leitrim.
So would the people who, like the Stone Age people, would they have been living by the lake, or would they have been visiting there? What's your take on it?
Yeah, so presumably they were living in the wider area, but it's always very difficult to find the houses or the everyday kind of farmsteads of these people. And I suppose that's what was fantastic about this, that we're getting a real glimpse into the everyday lives of various prehistoric people. You know, we know from looking at the assemblage that it's not just one event in time, that probably what we're looking at is a collection of artifacts that built up potentially over thousands of years, so that we're getting people repeatedly coming to the lake. It would have been a real hub of activity, as you can imagine, people going there, you know, to get fresh water for their houses, for feeding their animals, for fishing, for catching fowl. There's a lot of duck in the area.
And had the area, Marion, been excavated like close by, like had it been an area of interest before this?
Well, no, this is the first prehistoric site that's known from this particular lake. We do have, you know, later activity from the early medieval period. You know, we have Cranoaks and a lot of ring forts around the area, which is, again, testifying to how important the lake was. But all of those sites are much, much later. They're more recent than the material that we have. So I suppose it's just that glimpse into the lives of these prehistoric people. They're probably using the lake for fishing quite a bit and just going back there, making tools, using those tools, and then leaving some of them behind.
Mm. And so has it been a huge find, considering, I know when I've done chats like this before, you might have 10 pieces of tools that have been found, but this is like close to 1,000.
Yeah, we have 930 pieces, and I suppose it's just the density of material that's really unusual. You don't tend to find dense concentrations of stone tools, or as we call them, lithics, in one place, especially if you're not actually looking for them, if it's not, during an archaeological excavation. So, yeah, I mean, in my own history of working on excavations, the most we might have found at any of my sites would be 20 or 30 pieces. So this is, you know, pretty intense concentration of material and activity. So, yeah, it's really exciting. And I suppose as the research goes forward, you know, and picking apart the different periods that might be represented and what kinds of activities that people were carrying out at the lake, that's going to be really interesting. Mm.
Well, listen, it's a picnic not to be forgotten anyway. So.
That's for sure.
Well, listen, lovely chatting to you today, and best of luck with kind of discovering that and what's to come out of it, and labelling everything and getting it on show. Marion Dowd, thanks for chatting to me.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Lads, your songs are coming in thick and fast. The guys upstairs are compiling fabulous tracks, fabulous music. Joe Dolan, Good Looking Woman, ABBA, Dancing Queen. I used to be a DJ. That has to be the number one. I would walk 500 miles. The Proclaimers. Brian says, The Siege of Venice, every wedding favourite, and Groan, Duty Dance. Says Brian in Barna. River Dance is another one that's just like lighting up the screen. House of Pain, Mr. Brightside, the Pogues version of the Irish Rover, Saturday Night by Wakefield. Oh my lord, do you remember that one? Anyway, keep them coming in and we'll have a little boogie later on after four. Alright, As You Were is released today to much critical acclaim, and its author Elaine Feeney joins us on the line. Good afternoon.
Hi, Catherine, how are you?
I am in flying form, and I'm about halfway through the book, which I started last night. I have to say, it's brilliant. I'm addicted already, and getting such a brilliant reaction. Are you delighted?
I am, but, you know, I've been a poet for, like, years and years, so I'm not used to getting any reaction. I want to go back in under the bed.
Well, I mean, here's just, for example, I just pulled out, I was going through Twitter, and Marion Keyes said, As You Were was just effing amazing. Rim full of brilliant characters. What an exciting, visceral, poetic read. I adore the lack of sentimentality. It gives permission to Irish women to put themselves first. And considering what we've come from, that's seismic. Elaine Feeney is such a talent. I loved it.
Now,
you'd have to put your feet up and be delighted with yourself on that one.
Yeah, I'm very self-critical though. So, yeah.
Are you?
I was thrilled that Marion actually tweeted that around Christmas time. And I remember sitting down on the couch, and I started going, oh my God, Marion Keyes likes the book. It's such a relief. I think, you know, I spent 4 years, you know, writing that book on my own with my editor. And obviously, when it goes out into the public, it's such a different thing then. You know, being a writer is a very personal journey, and I'm kind of an introverted extrovert, so it's a bit complex.
And can I ask you why you went from poetry? Because I know you've written 4 poetry collections. What was it that, was this something, this fiction novel, was it brewing inside you for a while? Had it been building for a while?
Well, I think in my 20s, I had my children in my 20s, and I got very ill on both pregnancies. So it was hard to find the time, I suppose. Poetry was quicker, and it was probably more immediate, which isn't a very literary answer to that question. But in 2014, then I got very ill. And I think I actually let myself get very ill in 2014. I thought I was stressed, and I thought I was running around with the busy, as we'd say here. And I ended up in hospital being resuscitated, and a doctor saying to me, why did you let yourself get so sick? You know, you had about an hour to live. And then after that, I was in recovery for a long time after that. And just the hospital experience kind of piqued an interest in me in camaraderie and women and women's stories. And the eye of poetry just didn't suit the story I wanted to tell.
Can I be completely rude and cut across you there? Sorry, you had an hour to live. You went into respiratory failure.
Respiratory failure. I was at home and I had an infection. And you see, when you're sick, I think you don't want to be the sick person anymore. So I was the sick woman with the pregnancies, you know. And I just thought, I can fight this. And I don't know, I put a lot of pressure on myself to be at home and say, you know, I can do the Lemsips and I'll be fine. And my mother came into the house one day and she said that my eyes were yellow and she just said, that's it, hospital now.
Wow, okay.
and literally had to carry me. I just didn't want to go in. And I think that led me sort of consider this idea of, you know, someone in a hospital telling you you had so little time. But you never know the sweet spot, do you? You never know. Like, if you go in too early with the kids with a runny nose, they're like, what are you doing in the hospital?
I know. And we think, yeah, we think we're invincible. We think we are invincible. Yeah. And you always have the to-do list and you need to get it done before you address anything about yourself. And that actually makes so much sense to me now, having gotten through halfway through the book. So actually, let's talk about the book and give us the rundown. Give the listeners the rundown.
Yes, so Sinead Hines is this very ambitious 39-year-old property developer. Very busy woman, and one day she gets a devastating diagnosis in the opening pages of the book, and she basically speeds off in her Volvo after getting the diagnosis in a hospital. She tells it only to a magpie that she sees on the bonnet of the car. And she goes back to her beautiful house that she hasn't spent much time in. She's three sons because she's been so busy with her life. And she's been very busy because she likes to distract herself also. She's had quite an abusive past that torments her and it's very intrusive. And she goes in. She goes home and she never finds the time to tell her husband, Alex, about her terrible secret. And I'm not going to go away from it because it's on the back and it's on the front page, the first page. And then 8 months later, she collapses and she ends up in hospital and she still holds the secret. And she ends up in a ward with two older women, working class matriarch Margaret Rose Sherlock, who runs her very good family from her rose gold mobile phone. And a woman in her 80s, Jane Lohan, who I love. I love Jane. I don't know, are you allowed to say that about your own characters?
But of course
I
you
love
are.
Jane. Yeah, yeah.
She has dementia.
She has dementia, but she has those moments of, you know, perfect memory also. And the saddest thing about Jane is she knows that she has this huge secret about a past lover called Anne, and she knows to keep it a secret, even in the moments of absolute awful forgetfulness and madness at times, you know. But Jane is also very hurt as well, you know, so it's quite a complex character.
Mm. Do you know what I think when I'm there? It's like eavesdropping.
Yeah, it's very auditory, and I think it's definitely a different style. I know some people were like, what's with the lists? And, you know, when Sinead goes back home, she delves into Google. And I've been thinking about that a lot. I mean, we all go into that deep dive into Google, don't we? We go from, you know, looking at maybe a pair of shoes and suddenly you're on to a war site and then you go on to something else and it's hopping constantly from subject to subject. And I think that's a very different way we are in the world now. Mm. It's very auditory. I'm very interested in the way people speak, in the way people speak to each other and in the speed of the way people speak.
And it's interesting because, you know, health is, it's such a private thing for all of us, and it's that moment, you know, when she gets her diagnosis, and it's either very unselfish that she doesn't tell her family or it's incredibly selfish that she, do you know what I mean? It's you can look at it either way.
I think that's going to be the crux of the book, and I think that's very much is the question, is it selfish or is it selfless? Mm. And I suppose, you know, I wrote it in that time just before repeal, where language was frantic, where women had a lot of skin in the game, where we were talking a lot, we were sharing, we were divulging our deepest and darkest, and sometimes things we may have preferred to have kept, you know. And I suppose if we believe in the autonomy or we believe in agency or the individual, is she selfless or selfish? I see her as selfless, but I mean, people have said it's really, really selfish. My sister Andrea said to me, she was reading it on one of the drafts, and she said, "She's frustrating me." And I said, "Yeah, but people keep these secrets, you know, and people have kept secrets to the grave. And I don't know, maybe it's the utter act of love."
Mm. And even when you think about, you know, even you from a hospital, going your own experience, your own hospital experience, waiting till the bitter end to go in, and it's a protection thing as well, I think, for a lot of people trying to protect their families, their loved ones from hurt and pain in any way that they can.
it's a whole other ordeal, isn't it? Going into a hospital, it becomes, you do, and what you said there about public and private is really, really important. You know, you become public. Sickness is a very public thing. I don't know, is that a peculiarly Irish thing? We always know who's sick and what's wrong with them. And we have these fine details about people's most inner, you know, where they might have actually faced up to things themselves and to face your own mortality like that. And it to be such a public thing must be really, really difficult. And also, you know, she's the busy mom as well. She's the busy mom, and it's a very big, noisy, intergenerational book. I wanted it to be big and rangy with women's voices at that stage in her life, because that's very similar to the stage of my life, you know.
And you would it's the ward setting is so interesting for that reason, because we've all been there in a hospital ward, and you do not know it you know, it doesn't matter, it just depends the day you go in, and it all comes down to timing and that sliding doors moment where you don't know who's going to be opposite you, who's going to be beside you, what situation and where they are in their lives.
Well, that's so absolutely true. And I remember being in hospital on my second son, and the day I was supposed to be discharged from hospital, I'd met two lovely women, and I met so many people through my hospital admissions. And one of them, they've become friends of mine, but one of them had a really, really difficult time in the week. We were in that, you know, the maternity ward that's not happy. That's what I call it. You know, there's the really happy maternity ward, and then there's the other maternity ward. And I had doctors had come in and said to me, you can't go home, you have a suspected brain clot. And it was really, I just was shocked. I was only 27 28, and one of the women came in to say goodbye because we thought we were all leaving, and I had been moved into a private room. And she said she was so upset, and she walked to Dunn's beside the hospital to get me all the things like pajamas and jelly sweets and cream and stuff like that. And that really influenced the novel, that camaraderie of a total stranger. And I'll never forget it. Now she's my friend now. But it's just because she understood what it was like to be stuck in there without things. And I think many people will have that experience of being able to share something very intimate with a stranger that you can't always tell your nearest and dearest.
You know? And then there's the moments where you are hidden behind a curtain, you know, and it's just that curtain for privacy. And you might not have the conversation, but what is being said through that curtain can have quite the impact.
That's, you know, and we're not soundproof. And
no.
I think that's the thing. And, you know, with all due respect, you know, people are working under very difficult circumstances in a hospital. And I mean, look at the past. The past few months have thrown up something that we never in our wildest dreams ever expected. It's just been truly awful. But, you know, they come in and they close the curtain, and there's, you know, they're often polite. You know, everyone has their own hospital stories. But you can hear absolutely everything. So there has to be a trust. And I think, you know, we build up very intimate relationships with people very quickly. I mean, if we were to go to a hotel today, you know, two people who'd never met before, and we were to share a room, we'd be a bit like awkward about it. But in hospital, you're put straight in there, and you might not even have a pajama. You know, you could come
it's
in
so
like
true.
with hardly any clothes that could be cut off you, and that's it. And I think you lie in hospital then, and you don't know, are you allowed to do anything? Can I go to the bathroom? Is that okay? Blah blah blah, and you lose all your independence, I think.
You isolated like all of us in lockdown, and you did 75 days of isolation tweets. Where did that decision come from?
I forget that people can read publicly. that decision, I don't know, I just started it off one day because of being like health compromised. I went straight into isolation. I mean, at the start of it, I didn't see anyone for months. I had my husband. I said, you can go to work, but you can stay in a hotel. And then eventually he's working from home. So I just started to put up, you know, we all hit the ground running, I think, Catherine, with that, with the Zoom and the banana bread and all that. But then I went to visit my sister when we were allowed to go to other houses. And I felt disingenuous. I had to stop it. But a lot of my friends said, will you do it again for autumn?
Well, I think you should. And
yeah.
Camille, I know as well you teach both in college and in secondary school. And had you been back at secondary school? Like, had you already gone back before COVID and before everything shut down?
Oh, I had. I'd been back for, so 2014, 2015, maybe 18, around 2016, I think.
Okay.
I went back to secondary school. Yeah, I had been back. And I was one of those like crazy teachers going around with the Dettol wipes and wiping the door handles and wiping the tables. And yeah, so it was starting to get very panicky, I thought. Mm. The kids were wonderful, you know, but it was just really, so I had been back. And I was back, yeah, I'm in NURG as well, teaching creative writing. So I don't know what that landscape looks like for September. I'd say very much a Zoom landscape for college for a while, but.
And you've got two sons, so you've an 18-year-old and a 13-year-old. Mm-hmm. So how are they about going back to school, or what to? One is doing the Leaving Cert.
Yeah, Dan's going into Leaving Cert now, and he was great. And I have to say, he goes to the.
Oh, I think we've lost Elaine there. Hello. No, she's gone, I think. Yeah, I think the line is gone. Anyway, she's lovely to chat to her. Elaine Feeney is the author, and the book is called As You Were. Can't recommend it highly enough. And she was just talking to us about schools there, and I see some school texts coming in here. Our school informed us yesterday that our children can no longer use school bags. They have to use shopping bags to bring in their books. I'm not looking forward to the first day photos. That comes in from a listener. And then lots more Micheál and Mhuire Hertig texts coming in here. He's a beautiful person. Happy birthday to you. Huge congrats. Highlight of my week, listening to the magnificent Micheál and Mhuire Hertig on the great celebration of his 90th birthday, an Irish treasure. Cohortigas of Micheál. Lovely text coming in there. And you know what? I can't even read the screen for the dance tunes that are coming in. So we'll get back to them after four. But Anish Toshian am to Priyev Scalta Lenukta Lamarian Nihulawan. Gurmahagat Marion. Okay, we were looking for your top five dance floor fillers, and lads, the texts were flying in. And by God, you've got some great taste in music, has to be said. These were the ones that you told us got you up off your seats and out onto the dance floor. Are you ready? Here you go. At number five, it'll get the grannies and aunties doing a jig in a line. It's none other than Riverdance. At number four, no Irish festival is complete without it. It is Mark McCabe's dance classic, Maniac 2000. Every single person in the house tonight, that day you're singing, she's a maniac. She's a maniac on the floor. And she's dancing. Oh, what a tune. At number three, we dare you not to dance and get those knees knocking to Brendan Boyer's Hucklebuck. Do the Hucklebuck. Oh God, I just want to be at a wedding. I want to be at a wedding right now on the dance floor. Number two, you won't have far to look for a dance partner to swing around the dance floor to. Galway Girl. So I took her hand and I gave it a twirl. And then I lost my heart to a Galway girl. But at number one, and by far the most popular on our very unofficial text and email poll, you won't be able to sing along without trying your best Scottish accent. It's 500 Miles by the Proclaimers. Enjoy. Oh, sang the whole way through that. Absolutely love it. And well, actually, we stopped and Googled, Niamh and myself, halfway through to see how long it would take you to walk 500 miles. And a normal walking pace, like not too fast and not too slow, is considered to be 4 miles an hour. So therefore, 125 hours to walk 500 miles. You don't have to question it anymore. Brilliant track and good choice by all of you, I have to say. Now, while many of you were battling down the hatches last night in preparation for Storm Ellen, Annie Birney was getting ready for her first major storm on the Blasket Islands. And you'll probably know that her and Owen Boyle were selected out of a whopping 42,000 applicants for a once-in-a-lifetime job on the Great Blasket Island. And they've been living there as caretakers since the end of June. Annie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Catherine. We're all okay here. Thanks.
Good. Good. How did you get on last night with Storm Ellen?
Well, it was an eventful couple of hours, as I'm sure it was for many people around the country. We had a good dose of rain last night, so we were kind of making sure that everything was okay with the three cottages here that we look after on the island, and making sure all the windows were closed. What we didn't expect to happen was there was a little river of water ran in through the back door and out the front door for about 20 minutes last night, and then kind of calmed down. So okay. We had a bit of excitement, but thankfully we're grand here. You know, the wind is howling, but we have the fire going, so we can't complain.
And because I know I was only out with you there a couple of weeks ago, and we'll be featuring the Blasket Islands on Sunday on No Place Like Home at 6:30. So I got to meet yourself and Owen. Was that 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that? Now
I'd say so.
Yeah. And it was busy then, and the three cottages were busy with overnighters and tourists. So how did you prepare for it when you got the weather warnings? Did you have to get people to leave, or how did you manage that?
Yeah, well, I suppose Alice and Billy, who we'd work very closely with, they are always keeping an eye on the weather. They look after the cottages as well here, so they're able to give people warning. Anybody who was staying overnight in the cottages, and then those people had a think about whether they'd like to stay, I suppose, those few days until things calmed down on the Blasket Sound and the crossings were available again, or whether they'd head home. So the people who were here on the island decided to head home, and after that we watched the boats go, and that was a very strange feeling. The island gets very, very quiet then, and then we were, I suppose, just making sure that anything that could blow away was maybe secured away or tied down or something like that, you know. And as well, thankfully, just having a look around our own house here and making sure there wasn't too many things stored down on ground level as well.
And yeah, it must be that feeling. In one way, I would have thought it was nice that, you know, yourself and Owen get the island to yourself for a little while, because it can get busy, and with the weather, the sort of run of good weather, it's been busy for you guys there. And I think people sort of forget, like, it's a lot of heavy duty work. I saw you with buckets and mops, and you were scrubbing and making beds and hauling up the laundry. Actually, I carried up a bag of laundry for you, if I'm not mistaken.
You did, Catherine. Thanks very much. That really made a difference. Thank you. I suppose, you know, because there's no electricity on the island, you know, we are scrubbing the cottages and making sure that they're really cosy and really clean for people when they arrive. That's so important at the moment. But I'm developing all these muscles I never knew I had, you know, because you're bringing the coal, you're just scrubbing at everything, you're heating up the water. And then thankfully for us, the sheets and the towels and everything like that are washed and dried on the mainland, because it would be really tricky for us to manage that here. But then anything that comes onto the island gets hauled up, and you walked up that pier many times as well, so you know the steepness of the hills around here and that slip coming up. So it is, I suppose, you know, when you sit down at the end of the day, you know, you've earned your little sit down and a cup of tea. You know, it's really physical, but I suppose it's kind of that kind of rewarding work as well, you know.
Sure. And how have you both settled into to new life on the Blaskets? I mean, there was stuff that sort of had thrown up its head that you weren't expecting, and then in other ways, you know, it's kind of given you so much that you couldn't have even imagined.
Absolutely. Like, I think every day nearly we'll just take a moment and just try to remember and realise how lucky we are to be here. You know, it's a real privilege, and I suppose to be here in 2020 when we have the luxury maybe of taking a day off today and lighting up the stove and looking out at that weather, as opposed to being out in it, you know. I think the last couple of days have shown us just we're so grateful to have our little cosy cottage and that little bit of shelter on the island. I suppose we've learnt a lot, and we'll still continue to learn, I'd say, until the end of September when we're off the island. We're developing kind of problem-solving skills and, you know, forward planning and things like that, because there's not much you can leave to chance here, because, of course, it's not a case of just, you know, popping down to the shop if we forget somebody's tea bags or something in one of the cottages. So we're constantly trying to keep ahead of ourselves. But we've also been very, very lucky as well since we got here, because we've had an incredible amount of support, not only from people, I suppose, Alice and Billy, you know, and other people on the mainland as well. The people that we meet on the island are very kind. And then from our parents and our families as well. So Owen's parents, Mary and Joe, visited a little while ago, and they brought a load of treats from the mainland, and they're coming in handy now. And my parents, Jane and Des, they got me a little storm lamp before I came here, so we're lighting that up every evening as we look out at the waves. So,
and you have good mobile coverage there, because you have the phone mast, which is great.
We've great mobile coverage, yeah, which I think makes a difference because it just, you know, we've been sending letters and we've gotten a few lovely letters, but it is nice just to be able to send a WhatsApp as well, and it makes you feel like maybe you're not too far away either.
Mm. Yeah, well, I have to say it's such, I absolutely adored it. And it was only my second time out there, and I just learned so much about my family history, which I didn't know. And on my mom's side of the family, sure, you were there. It was like I discovered there's 8 generations of my family. They came from the Blaskets. They settled on the Blaskets and they were there for since 1800. So it was an amazing privilege to learn that. And it is such a special place. And if anybody gets the opportunity to go and spend a night there, it's magical. It really is. It's absolutely magical. And
it is.
Yeah. And yeah. Pat has just texted in here. He said, Catherine, please shout out to Kieran and Clemmie. They're on holidays in Kerry at the moment. They're on the Blasket Islands right now. And 500 Miles, the song I just played, The Proclaimers, was their first dance at the wedding. So you may it doesn't get any more Irish than that. So you may go seek them out, but they could be listening to the radio at the moment. But you can pass on if they're not listening to the radio, if they're down on that beautiful Trabawn, if they're down looking at the seals, if they're walking the back part of the island.
Hope they're not today now.
Oh yeah, let's hope they've got the fire on and the feet up.
Yeah.
That comes in from Pat for Kieran and Clemmie. And Camir, how is Owen doing?
Owen is flying.
Good.
Oh my goodness, he is after taking to this life like nobody's business now. So he's getting on great now. I think he's actually just popped out just together to look at the waves going over Beginnish now. So he's getting on great, and he's when I talk about the problem solving, Owen is the man for the problem solving.
Yeah,
so he's always thinking outside the box.
And I know, just to say as well, for people asking, a couple of texts coming in, the cafe is closed out there this summer because of COVID, but the accommodation is very much open. And again, it's just weather dependent on the boats and whether they can get out here or not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It hasn't been that many since we've come here at the end of June. There's only been one or two days now that we've seen like this where the crossing was impossible.
What do you love the most about it, Annie?
Oh, that's a great question. I suppose for me, it's the experience of, I suppose, just being so close to this wildness and this nature, and having read some of the books about the Blasket Island to know how special it is to experience what those people were talking about, you know. So I suppose, like, one of the first things we did when we came to the island is we did the tour of Bonavaglia, the village, and that's absolutely fantastic. That was brilliant. And I suppose, you know, I'm sitting here in front of the fire this morning, and because we have a morning off, I said, look, I'm going to read, you know, little bits of the books again, and just the privilege of being able to experience on some tiny little level what those people were writing about. So for me, it's the history and the heritage of the place, and the language as well. There's an incredible, lovely Irish language associated, and I suppose I'd have a great respect for that as well. I'm trying to speak as much as I can while I'm here. And then for Owen, I think Owen is having a ball with the nature of the island, so he's just really enjoying all the amazing insect life, but then the animals that you'll see around the island, the hares and the donkeys and the seals as well. So between us, I think we're having a great time, you know.
And I know I'm biased, but even when you're talking about the writers there, Lorcan Ní Cineda, who runs the Blasket Island Centre, which is free at the moment as well. If you're down around that neck of the woods in Kerry, get out to it. They've got a lovely new walkway built out there, but the Blasket Island Centre is phenomenal. And again, I was just completely ignorant to the amount of writing that came from the Blaskets as well. Loads of amazing books. Anyway, it's been lovely to catch up with you, Annie. Mind yourself.
Thanks very much, Catherine.
And hopefully the weather clears up for you. Thanks a mil.
Thank you. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
I have been joined in studio by the happy pair who always come in with a smile on their face. It is great to see you. And you've come in. First of all, you've come in and I have people to look at, which I'm always delighted about because most of this is down the phone. And then you've come in with a basket of delicious goodies and bread and pestos and all sorts.
Yeah.
So I just just even
we're
on
winning.
Yeah,
we're winning.
You're winning already.
I'm delighted. I think it's part of the fruits of our work. You know, if we're an accountant, you can't really give spreadsheets. But when you play with food, it's like, oh, look what we have.
Yay.
And if you're a feeder, if you start a food business, you're typically a feeder. So.
And the lemon basil pesto. I mean, your famous pesto. I'm just love it. That's
well, we have more. We brought in. The family has got bigger.
Okay, we won. What's this one here?
We have a new roasted red pepper one, and we've got all sorts of like dips and hummuses and pestos. We're very good at.
Yeah, you certainly are. You're also good at cookbooks, lads. And this is the fourth cookbook. And I was just saying to you during the break. First of all, I have to say, happy pair are David and Stephen Flynn as well. Like, does anybody know the difference between the two of you, or do they just say, "Hey, lads"?
We just about know we got two names. Yeah. So it really doesn't matter at all. Our whole lives of it, so.
Come here. The book is fabulous. And I was saying to you, it's very different the way it's laid out and how you've gone about it. Instead of just, you know, your individual recipes and your how-to and heat the oven here, heat the oven there. It's a very different, you've come at it in a different way. So try and explain that to us.
Definitely. Yeah, it was quite like... I think we wanted it. It was our fourth cookbook, so we didn't want to do the same thing. We wanted to really mix it up. And I guess we've been eating a plant-based diet for 15 years. And yeah. Dave wants to talk.
I was only going to say, the whole idea was to try to make it simple. Over the years, like we've done, this is our fourth one. So we wanted to show that people could swap out ingredients, because we've heard throughout the years that people want to learn more than follow a recipe. So this one is a framework where you can see how you can swap. If you don't have chopped tomatoes, you can put in coconut milk. If you don't have peppers, you can put in mushrooms. If you don't like leeks, you can put in onions, you know, where we've kind of mapped it out so you can actually try to customize it.
And I read an article where you said you kind of approached it as if you were writing it for your kids, which I think is a really good analogy, because people are scared to experiment.
Yeah.
So when you actually put, you know, when you just have one recipe, they go, exactly that. I don't have pine nuts, or I don't have tomatoes, or I don't have whatever. So this is on the one page, then you've got like five different options of how you may...
How things relate to each other. I guess we've been chefs for about 15 years, and we kind of take it for granted that I can come into any kitchen and just put ingredients together and cook a dinner, that type of thing. And it was to try to carry that perspective and to put it in paper and try to share it to inspire people. Like, the goal of the book is that you don't need the book. But you finish not needing a recipe book, that you finish kind of going, okay, I feel like I can cook a bit more intuitively. I can understand the relationship of the components, and I can do it.
Okay, so the best way I suppose that I can try and make, you know, to make sense of what you guys are saying, what I'm trying to say to the listeners is, let's start with granola.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, great.
The way you've worked the granola. One, the pictures are amazing. By the way, there's not one handstand or naked torso.
No.
I thought I was going to be disappointed. But actually, the food photography is so good. I don't miss your torsos.
Lovely. So, very good. I love that.
So the granola, right? And the way you've done it. So talk us through the first page of the granola.
So granola, we make literally tons of granola. And many people kind of get confused. What is granola? Where is its place? But granola, in essence, is a toast. Oat muesli, if you will. That's a little bit more indulgent, but an easy way to think of a recipe is 50% oats or grain of choice that is rolled into a flake. You have 10% nuts, 10% seeds, 10% liquid oil, you've 10% dried fruit, and you've 10% liquid sweetener of choice. So that's literally it. So
apply that down to a recipe, so you'd literally take your oats, mix it with your oil and maple syrup, which is, say, if you've got 500 grams of oats, you got 100 ml of maple syrup, you got 100 ml of sunflower oil. You might mix your nuts. Oh, I don't have almonds. Asher, I'll put walnuts. Asher, I've got too many seeds. So you could, you know, you got 200 grams of nuts and seeds. Mix that all through it. Split it out in two baking trays. Put it in the oven, 160 for 20 minutes.
Done.
When it's nice and golden, take it out, leave it cool. Put some dried fruit in, and boom.
Fabulous. I mean, that's it, because it's like, that's what was really obvious to me. It's the 50% oats, then 10% nuts, 10% seeds, 10% dried fruit. So that's, it's just
10%
really,
oil and 10% sweetener.
And if you want to do 10 kilos, if you're cooking for 100 people, it's easy to apply. Or if you want to do it for two people, it's easy. It kind of empowers you to adjust it to your...
Okay, then the other one that stood out for me then was your veggie burgers, your vegan burgers. So again, textured vegetable protein, TVP.
Okay. Well, we broke down the burgers into different types, because there is people that like a meaty type of vegetable burger. So there is kind of meat substitute type ones with TVP and vital wheat, gluten, and weird ingredients like that. But then we have other ones which are made of vegetables that people would recognize. So it's a whole food burger where we've gone with grain of choice, such as quinoa and couscous or brown rice. You've got your beans. beans, you know, because bean is going to be what's going to bind it. You're probably going to have psyllium husk or corn flour or flaxseed. And then you're going to probably put in some kind of veg. So fried mushrooms, you might put in leek or peppers or whatnot, different kind of mushrooms. And then flavor agents such as, you know, soy sauce or tamari or spices, salt, black pepper, you know, all these various components. And, you know, once you put that together and mash them down into patties, you're going to put really tasty burgers.
And the other one that I loved was your salad page, because I think that's what people think as well. Boring salad, like green salad, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
rabbit
whereas
food.
Actually it's a double page of salads, and you've got it. And just when you open it up, you go, okay, I have now like six different salad choices there and how you can mix and match them.
Yeah.
So it just makes it accessible for people and makes you, it switches the brain on a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's to move away from this quantification of everything to more the qualitative, as in to go back to more intuitive, like work with taste, work with flavor, trust yourself more, stop needing others to tell you. We all are imbued with this sophisticated tongue that has incredible ability to taste food. And I think the more we can trust it and go, that doesn't taste good. Okay, what does it need? Okay, needs a little bit of salt. Okay, tastes a little bit claggy. I'm going to put a little bit of acid to cut through it. Needs a little bit extra, a little bit of umami. So I think it's to understand how these components relate to each other, you can understand how to season and flavor better.
Yeah.
But the first, so big thanks to everyone who's bought it, because it was our first book that's been an international bestseller. It ended up, it Woo! Hit the Irish bestsellers, which was amazing. But in the UK, it ended up being number 10, which was amazing in the first
Unreal.
Week it came out. So that we're really, really chuffed with that.
You should be. And come here, are you delighted to be back up and running again? Because lockdown obviously has been strange for a lot of people. You had to close and do takeouts.
Well, it was weird for us because like the Happy Pair has been part of our life for 15 years. And like that's kind of, if you tell me what was my ideal day, I'd say, well, I'd be up playing shop a little bit, I'd be wagging my tail. But we didn't have that outlet anymore, so we had 3 months to kind of take our time. And like we closed because we just took the chance to close, and
we felt it was the right thing to do. But
for sure.
I guess it gave us a chance to focus on other things, and now it's great to be back open and
we opened a bakery.
A sourdough bakery. So
everybody else was making really crap sourdough during lockdown, you guys have made wonderful sourdough.
Yeah, I guess it's been a pet project of mine for about 4 years, and I've been kind of tinkering around with kind of the idea of Levan and your sourdough culture and how it works together. And you know,
is it hard to do it on a big scale?
Yes,
it's a different gig. Like it's easy enough, like many people can kind of master the art of making 1, 2, 3 loaves at home using their Dutch oven, and it's a beautiful process. But then to move that to this big oven, that, you know, it's kind of like it has the power of 3 houses. It's, you know, cost, you know, a lot of money, and it's 4 decks, and it can bake 60 loaves at the same time, and you can control top heat, bottom heat, steam injectors, front heat, back heat. So it really, there's a lot more bells and whistles to play with, but great fun. Really fun.
Brilliant. Yeah, really, well, listen, as always, it's a pleasure to see you. And I know there was a huge community spirit up with you guys, and you were dropping in bread. I was kind of following you on Instagram, dropping bits and pieces around the community. Congrats on everything. Massive success. The book again is called The Happy Pair, Vegan Cooking for Everyone, and it's available nationwide for €20.
And it really is for everyone. It's not like people, you know, the title might put people off, that's just for vegans, but it really is. It's for just to try to get everyone to eat more fruit and veg.
Fabulous. And I'm heading off with me pesto, delighted with life. Lads, thanks for
Thanks,
Happy Pair. Mary Wilson is on the way with Drive Time. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.